Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, January 22, 2026. Student Union Commons renamed in donor's honor. The Student Union Commons at Parkland College will now bear the name of a late community leader who was extremely supportive of the college. Following a vote by the Board of Trustees Wednesday night, the south end of the Student Union will now be known as the Chaplain Student Commons in honor of George Chaplain, following a $1 million gift to the Parkland College Foundation in his memory that was facilitated by his children, Charlie Mark and Laura Chaplin. "It's really a gift from Dad," Charlie Chaplin said. His passion was the community, and he also had a passion for education. And Parkland does both of those things because the people that go to school there come back to our community and do good things. And I think he always saw the value in that. Per a memo to the board, half of the gift will be directed to the college's general nursing fund, with the other half directed to the foundation's general unrestricted fund to be used where the need is greatest. The sum will be paid out over a 5-year period. According to college officials, George Chaplin co-chaired the foundation's Creating Brighter Futures major gift campaign, which concluded in 2005 and raised $14 million. He also partnered with local organizations and individuals to support academic programs and provide scholarships. Over the years, he graciously gave his time, energy, ideas, and financial support to the college, Parkland officials said, adding that George Chaplin also established a scholarship in his own name in 2003 and was instrumental in the purchase of lab equipment used in the health professional department. He was awarded an honorary degree by the college in 2006 and received the Parkland College Foundation Lifetime of Entrepreneurship Award in 2015. "I'm glad he can do something that honors our father and what he championed in life," Charlie Chaplin said. "Education was something he supported, especially in the trades, and believed strongly in the impacts it can have, both in his life and for others. I think he believed in people who are willing to take the leap, and we just want his legacy to be part of what helps Parkland make that possible. Parkland College empowers students to build brighter futures for themselves, their families, and their communities by providing access to high-quality education, and the foundation ensures the resources are in place for that mission to thrive," said Parkland President Pam Lau. "This generous gift from the Chaplin family in George's honor opens new doors for learning, growth, and advancement, creating opportunities for more students to achieve their goals." According to college officials, the Student Commons area of the U-Wing will be renamed the Chaplin Student Commons for a minimum of 20 years. The announcement from Parkland comes just a few days after the University of Illinois Division of Intercollegiate Athletics confirmed that the East Circle Drive of the State Farm Center will be renamed George Chaplin Family Drive in honor of a $1 million gift made in his memory. There's a photo on the front page of the News Gazette with the headline, "Six-Piece Dreams," and the caption, "Orange Crush members cheer for free McDonald's McNuggets, which they'll receive if they redeem the offer quickly, thanks to a Maryland player who missed two consecutive free throws Wednesday at the State Farm Center in Champaign." Rantoul man gets 100 years for fatal stabbing. A Rantoul man has been sentenced to 100 years in prison for a murder and attempted murder in which he, for unknown reasons, entered the home of two of his friends and attacked them each with a knife. Alex Munabuta, 24, was found guilty in November trial for March 22, 2025, stabbing that left 22-year-old Nathan Goodman of Champaign dead and his girlfriend Katie Lacey with a near-fatal wound to the neck, among other injuries. Medical intervention saved Lacey's life, but as she testified at Munabuta's sentencing hearing Wednesday, that life was changed forever. "Justice is served, but justice doesn't bring Nathan back," Lassie said. "He's not getting out, so it's better for the community." She described nightmares, ongoing effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, loneliness, and fear. She says she can't sleep for fear of someone trying to finish what Alex started, and that even her loving memories of Mr. Gudeman have all been made painful by what she experienced. "The last time we were ever together, he was getting murdered in front of me," Lassie told Champaign County Judge Randy Rosenbaum, urging him to impose a serious sentence on the man who committed the murder. It was, in all likelihood, the last time she would have to recount that traumatic night in a courtroom, and Lassie said she's ready to move forward with her life for herself and for Mr. Gudeman. Only an hour or so after leaving the sentencing hearing, Lassie was off to work, headed to coach the boys' swim team at Centennial High School. "The sentencing was just one more thing that didn't go wrong," Lassie said. "Now it's about rebuilding my life and recovering from the emotional and physical effects." Though she was in large part physically recovered, Lassie said she may be up for another surgery to continue work on her voice and allow her to speak at louder volumes than she is currently able to. Mr. Gudeman's mother also shared a victim impact statement, describing how she struggles to even meet new people because it's common to ask about children. She doesn't know how to respond to questions about how many she has or what they're like. "Alex Muenabuta took all of Nathan's potential away," she said. "Our family has been handed a life sentence of grief." She said that the song that has been planned for Lassie and Mr. Gudeman's first dance at their wedding instead played at his funeral. Assistant State's Attorney N. Chi Lin argued for a life sentence for Muenabuta on the murder charge, recapping evidence presented at trial that he had left his phone behind and turned off his vehicle's dash camera during the time of the murder suggested planning. Lin also pointed out how the only apparent motive for the stabbing was that Muenabuta may have heard audio of Lassie giving his girlfriend advice after a disagreement. To the defendant, Nathan was collateral, Lynn said. She played audio of him on the phone less than 20 minutes after the incident, which Muenabuta claimed he'd seen the aftermath of, but not committed, in which he was not audibly upset or speaking about what he'd seen at all. Public defender Elizabeth Pollock explained Muenabuta's decision not to make a statement for himself at the sentencing, saying that he had determined it was better not to make the victims' families listen to him talk anymore. She said that while it was still difficult to explain what happened here, Muenabuta still had no prior history of violence or crime beyond traffic tickets and still had value to his family and the community. Ultimately, Rosenbaum said that the lack of apparent motive, while strange, had no bearing on the fact that Muenabuta had been convicted of murder. He described the defendant's actions as callous and showing a lack of remorse after the fact. Rosenbaum said that using a firearm can add years to a sentence because the Illinois General Assembly is attempting to reduce gun violence, that he saw this as a case that demonstrated how a criminal could be even more heinous without a gun. The defendant was convicted of stabbing two different individuals, physically touching them, using force over the course of minutes multiple times, feeling their breath, Rosenbaum said. He described again Lassie's account of how she was playing dead after being stabbed multiple times, and yet Muenabuta pulled her up by the hair, reached around, and slit her throat. Muenabuta still will serve his 70-year sentence for murder at 85% and his 30-year sentence for attempted murder at 100%. He has credit for 306 days of time previously served. Urbana School Board, disciplinary reforms on tap to fix racial disparity. The Urbana School District is looking to revamp disciplinary measures after an internal review revealed a racial disparity in exclusionary practices across the district. Exclusionary practices are disciplinary actions that remove students from learning environments such as suspensions and expulsions. The Illinois State Board of Education tends to lean against that method of discipline in the Illinois School Code, particularly as research showed that exclusionary practices mostly impacted black students, especially black males, said Chastity Beckless, Urbana's Director of Equity and School Improvement. "When the kids are not present, they are losing access to instruction," Beckless said, highlighting how exclusionary practices alongside chronic absenteeism can contribute to other issues within a school. The district has been found to be in the top 20% of schools in the state for use of exclusionary practices in the last 7 years. Data from across the district from 2017 through 2024 also revealed that exclusionary practices were also used disproportionately on students of color each year. For example, of the 4,134 students enrolled for the 2025 school year, there were a total of 952 white students in the district. Of incidents attributed to that group, 109 resulted in students being disciplined with expulsion or suspension. Of incidents attributed to the district's 3,182 students of color, 1,599 of them black, 892 resulted in expulsion or suspension. Becla spoke to the Urbana School Board Tuesday night to present an action plan to reduce the use of exclusionary discipline in general and especially to reduce racial disproportionality in those practices. It's part of the same discipline improvement plan that was active for the 24-25 school year, which Becla said she wanted to see continue with minimal change in order to stay focused on the same priorities. The board unanimously approved her request. The plan includes frequent data reviews that include racial data to understand the current situation and how new practices change it. Becla said one goal in moving forward with new and hopefully improved disciplinary practices includes arming staff with this type of data to help them understand why new measures are important. That means sharing information not just with administrators, but also employees who work hands-on with students every day. It also means getting an understanding of what behaviors are being punished and what might be causing them. Becla said that both disruptive behavior and physical aggression are rampant across the district. The plan would look at how we unpack what disruptive behavior looks like and the lens of cultural responsiveness to that as well. Power struggles and implicit bias, but then how we also work with our students on that conflict resolution, Becla said. As for actual disciplinary action, the plan focuses on targeted social-emotional learning interventions for at-risk students and intensive individualized support for students with chronic behavioral issues. The former applies to Tier 2 students who are at a higher risk of suspension or expulsion, with intervention measures, counseling, behavioral support plans, and small group sessions. The latter applies to students who may need more one-on-one support. Either way, the idea is to get in with those students and work on behaviors of concern to avoid getting to the point that exclusionary practices are necessary. Both levels also involve tracking behavior of individual students and regular check-ins with involved staff to make sure they are being supported in their efforts. Farm-focused, Ken Edelman Left of Forest and Camden Utterback of Robinson are backlit by the DK Tanks and Culverts display Wednesday as they chat at the Midwest Ag Expo at Gordyville. More than 175 exhibitors have displays at the show, which continues today. Teacher of the Week, Michael Carpenter, English Language Arts, Jefferson Middle School. After spending his entire childhood in Urbana, Michael Carpenter thought he would become a high school teacher. Instead, he spent 8 years helping prepare students for high school, an opportunity he relishes. In his 8th year as an English language arts teacher at Jefferson Middle School, Carpenter has been instrumental in Jefferson students' reading growth, which ranks in the 70th percentile statewide. I became a teacher because I thought it would offer me an opportunity to be creative while also giving back to the community I grew up in. Initially, I wanted to teach in high school, but I'm so glad to have landed at Jefferson. The 8th graders I teach are terrific to work with. They're respectful, they're kind, and they're curious. I think they are starting to sense adulthood isn't far away, so they start to take things a little more seriously and think a bit deeper about real-world issues. Occasionally, they'll strike up a discussion that wouldn't be out of place in an AP English classroom. My favorite lesson to teach is a unit on the Holocaust, not because it's fun or enjoyable, but because it's necessary. The students are quick to find relevancy to things happening around the world today. My most fulfilling moments are when I run into a former student out in the wild, at the store, a restaurant, an Illini game, hearing, "Hey, Mr. Carpenter," and getting to catch up with former students who are a few years older and taller than I remembered is always a treat. I keep students engaged by being engaged myself. If I can express through my words and actions a passion for the material that I'm teaching, there's a better chance the students will be into it. I hope that when they see me be genuinely interested in the topics we're covering, it instills in them a desire to be lifelong learners. My favorite teacher and subject to study in school was, so many teachers to name, honestly, Mrs. Pete, 5th grade Thomas Paine, fostered so much creativity, even allowing me to write and direct a play with our class. Mr. Bechtel, math, Urbana High School, always brought a positive energy to class. Ms. Helm was the sponsor of Urbana High School's student newspaper, providing us with countless opportunities to take some creative risks. For that matter, the entire UHS English department was huge for me, including Mrs. Cappy and Mrs. Meng. I've modeled bits of my own style from every one of them. If I weren't a teacher, I would be. The beauty of being a teacher is I still have time to pursue other interests. I'm a musician who's been in bands since high school. I podcast about Illinois basketball and football. Basically, I can scratch some of those itches as hobbies instead of careers. Even within education, I teach a course at the University of Illinois, which is a thrill for me and kind of a full circle moment for me. We have Mike Hale's records and radio column, Voice of Hoosiers, Hop Jobs Before Finding Calling. We're going all over the road today, but first a quiz question. Americans streamed 1.5 trillion songs in 2025. If all those songs were played back to back, it would take 10 million years. What single song was streamed the most in 2025? It was also the most played song on the radio in 2025. Correct answer is at the end of my column. Since joining WDWS-WHMS a quarter century ago, I became a student of college football radio broadcasts. Over the course of every season, I would catch some portion of every Big Ten, Big 12, and SEC flagship radio station's broadcast, with an ear to what local station programming aired before and after the network play-by-play broadcasts. I've listened to a lot of Don Fisher, the voice of the Indiana Hoosiers. Monday night's college football playoff national championship game, many of you follow the play-by-play on the game with Fisher on one of ESPN's alternate feeds. Like our friend Johnny Holiday, voice of the Maryland Terrapins, Fisher's broadcasting roots can be traced to Top 40 Radio, just down the road at the legendary WBOW 1230 AM in Terre Haute. Don grew up in Rochelle, graduating from high school in 1965. Apparently, he went through six jobs in a little over a year. While at the sixth job, as a ticket clerk at the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad Station in Mendota, he saw a full-page ad in Sport for a home correspondence broadcasting course. Halfway through the course, he took a radio job in Butte, Montana. After 15 months, he was back in Illinois calling games on radio in Ottawa and Springfield. When the Springfield station dropped Sports, he reached out to Joe Tate, manager and sports director at WBOW. Tate was about to move to Ohio to become the first radio voice of the Cleveland Cavaliers and recommend that Fisher take his place at WBOW's sports director. Fisher spun the top 40 hits during the day and did as many as 175 high school and college games per year. However, in 1973, WBOW's new owners decided to drop sports programming. Fortunately, a former boss at WBOW, Harvey Glor, had learned that Wire in Indianapolis had won the rights to create the first exclusive radio network for IU sports and was looking for an announcer and suggested that Fisher apply. The 26-year-old Don Fisher was among the last of 300 people to apply and got the job. Now he's spent 50-plus years going strong as the voice of IU. A couple of side notes. IU alums Mark Cuban and Todd Wagner wanted to listen to Fisher call IU basketball games, something nearly impossible in the early 90s at their homes in Dallas. They bought a majority interest in AudioNet in 1995 and started streaming games over the Internet. The company had been renamed Broadcast.com before they sold it to Yahoo for nearly $6 billion in 1999. I enjoyed listening to Fisher do the weekly Bobby Knight Network call-in radio show. Callers didn't get to talk to Knight on the air. A producer would write down the caller's question, then hand it to Fisher. Don would then skillfully, and I mean skillfully, ask Coach Knight the question. One of Fisher's first radio homes, 1230 AM, the original WBOW, is one of the two radio stations in Indiana that, as of the first of the year, has left the air. WBOW, Banks of the Wabash, was Terre Haute's first successful radio station, hitting the air in 1927. The broadcast license has been surrendered to the Federal Communication Commission. The other station, 102-year-old WGBF, 1280 AM Evansville, went silent on January 1st. While the station is still licensed, ownership is deliberating its next move. Both stations made their mark on Top 40 radio. WBOW 1230 AM with a 20-plus year run in the format. WGBF, owned by Illinois broadcaster Vernon Nolte. WJBC Bloomington and WROK Rockford. Sent Evansville into a frenzy in the mid-70s during their five-year run as AM Top 40 radio was beginning to fade. River City Rock WGBF went from the bottom of the ratings to the top overnight, but it was short-lived. The reality in AM radio is quite simple. If you don't invest in the product, just being on the air does not guarantee any modicum of success. If you have an on-air content that consumers want, it doesn't matter what platform you are on. Look at WDWS-AM, WILL-AM, WDAN-AM, WSOY-AM. All provide exclusive content and continue to thrive. Another factor for AM radio, especially in major markets, is the real estate value of the land where the transmitting towers reside. Two recent examples, WBBM 780 Chicago sold its 42-acre tower site for $46 million. It now shares a tower, Diplex, with WSCR 670. The result of that move, WBBM dropped daytime power from 50,000 watts to 35,000 watts. WMAL 630 in Washington, D.C., now doing Diplex, had its original 75-acre Four Towers transmitter site just off the Beltway, sold the land to Toll Brothers for $74 million with the intent of building 309 homes. Every month we see more heritage AM stations surrendering their licenses. The one positive, when a station pulls the plug and goes off the air, that creates less interference for the robust stations that remain on that frequency. Blake Nearman asked what area radio station has changed its call letters the greatest number of times. Interesting question I've never thought about. It looks like 95.3 Licensed to Rantoul started in the 60s as WRTL-FM, 1985 WRBZ, 1988 as WZNF, followed by WBNB, WEVX, WMYE, WLFH, and finally WJEK. Our mailbag writer, Kathy Reiser, asks, would any of you happen to know anything about Dick Wright's Rumpus Room Show on WKID 1580 radio, circa 1954? Looks as if it may have been an after-school show, whether for teens or younger kids, I don't know. If you have info, let us know. Thanks for your questions, suggestions, and topic ideas. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Notes from the newsroom. Our annual year-in-review special section that publishes Friday is an ode to retiring photo editor Robin Schulz. It includes her best work from 2025, and there was plenty of it. One of the state's most decorated photographers will call it a career after this year's men's basketball Final Four. She's hoping the Illini keep her busy into April. An Eastern Illinois grad, Robin began at the News Gazette on May 13, 1991. In 2017, she became photo editor. She's a big reason why we've been named Illinois Press Association's Newspaper of the Year, an unprecedented 10 times in 11 years. Her favorite part of the job? Not having to sit behind a desk, she said. Being able to get out and about and doing things I enjoy. I guess I'm pretty lucky. Trump drops tariff threat, cuts Arctic security deal. Davos, Switzerland. President Donald Trump on Wednesday scrapped the tariffs that he threatened to impose on 8 European nations to press for the U.S. control over Greenland, pulling a dramatic reversal shortly after insisting he wanted to get the island, including right title and ownership. In a post on his social media site, Trump said he had agreed with the head of NATO on a framework of a future deal on Arctic security, potentially diffusing tension that had far-reaching geopolitical implications. He said additional discussions on Greenland were being held concerning the Golden Dome missile defense program, a multi-layered $175 billion system that for the first time will put U.S. weapons in space. Trump offered few details, saying that they were still being worked out, but one idea NATO members have discussed as part of a compromise with Trump was that Denmark and the alliance would work with the U.S. to build more U.S. military bases on Greenland. That's according to a European official familiar with the matter, but not authorized to comment publicly. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said it was not immediately clear if that idea was included in the framework Trump announced. The president has threatened tariffs before, only to back away. In April, after first saying he would slap massive import levies on nations from around the world, which prompted a sharp negative market reaction, Trump eased off. But his change of heart this time came only after he used his speech at the World Economic Forum in the Swiss Alps to focus on Greenland and threaten to upend NATO, an alliance that has been among the globe's most unshakable since the early days of the Cold War. In his address, Trump said he was asking for territory that was cold and poorly located, and that the U.S. had effectively saved Europe during World War II while declaring of NATO. It's a very small ask compared to what we have given them for many, many decades. We probably won't get anything unless I decide to use excessive strength and force, where we would be frankly unstoppable. But I won't do that, okay? Trump said. Justices air doubts about President's power over Fed. The Supreme Court appeared ready to rule against President Donald Trump's attempt to immediately remove Federal Reserve Board member Lisa Cook, expressing skepticism during oral arguments Thursday about a president's control over the central bank. The Trump administration had asked the justices to overturn their lower court rulings that kept Cook in place while she challenges Trump's efforts to remove her over allegations of mortgage fraud. Congress gave members for cause protections in the law creating the Fed, and lower courts agreed that the firing was likely unlawful and reinstated Cook. During more than an hour and a half of arguments, the justices questioned not only Trump's request for the Supreme Court to allow him to remove Cook as her challenge plays out in court, but his arguments about the structure of government and the independence of the Federal Reserve. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, January 22nd, 2026. Please stay tuned for Part 2.